Okay, so I will continue right where Adrian left off. So as a brief recap, I'll be talking about the GD1 stellar stream in the era of Gaia. And the reason I've been excited about this single object or one particular feature within it for the whole year, or for the whole past year, is that our view of the stream has really has been transformed by the Gaia mission. So what I'm showing here are likely members of the GD1 solar stream, and they're colored and sized according to the membership probability. And so you can see that there's just a lot of structure in the stream that we just previously didn't know about. So we clearly see evidence of variations in both the width, the density along the stream, and what was most surprising to Adrian and I when we first made this plot is that there seems to be these stream stars that are off from the main body of the stream. And this has kind of been the holy grail. It looks like a site of perturbation, and we always hope that streams will tell us more than just the global shape about the, of the gravitational potential, but also about the whole history they had in this potential. So this is going to be the topic of the talk here, trying to understand if any of these features that we see, the gaps and the spur, whether we can tie that back to perturbations by something like a dark matter subhalo that could then potentially inform us about the nature of dark matter. And the reason we want to do that, of course, is really just to answer James Bullock's call. So, and 2 years ago, with Mike Bolan-Colchin, he wrote a review on the status of CDM paradigm on small scales. And they identified the search for dark matter subhalos below the mass of dwarf galaxies as the most urgent calling. We saw from Coral on Monday that dwarf galaxies themselves are very dark matter dominated, so they already tell us a lot about dark matter. And so if we, I'm showing here a power spectrum of subhalos or halos in different cosmologies, and just the mere detection of dark matter in dwarf galaxies can rule out some models. So here is where dwarf galaxies live, and we can clearly see in order to have them live in dark matter halos that the dark matter particle needs to be heavier than something like 3 keV. But there is a lot of parameter space at higher masses of dark matter particles and consequently lower mass subhalos. So what we are actually looking for would be subhalos, or well, I guess we want to test for the existence of subhalos at these masses of 10 to the 7 or 10 to the 6 solar masses. And it is really an honor to be in a room with three of the people who suggested the first test on how to get to it in the Milky Way. So we have here both Monica and Ray and Catherine, who almost, I guess, 10 years ago suggested that we might learn about the presence of dark matter subhalos from their impact on stellar streams. And so I'm showing here an image from the Catherine's group, where they simulated Palomar 5-like globular clusters and just bombarded them with dark matter subhalo. And so in each of these panels, they have... I see. Good. Okay. So in each of the panels, they had a different orbit of the on the cluster, and the impact happened where there is a gray cross. And what after like some time after the impact, what they notice is that there is like one feature that is predominant in most of these cases, and so there is like this presence of a big gap. And so there was a lot of literature in the subsequent years that tried to understand how the properties of these stream gaps depend on the properties of this perturbation. So yeah, there's just like a probably incomplete list of these many papers that basically said that if the perturber is moving slower, you get a larger gap. Also, the gap is larger if the perturber passes more closer to the stream, and also the gap is larger if you have a more massive perturber. And so there is like this well-established framework on how the gap properties relate to relate back to the properties of the perturber. But as Adrian pointed out, in like some models that Catherine ran, you can already see some features that are not just gaps like these stream folds. And this is exactly what we see in GD1. So we see both a combination of a gap and this spur feature. And just to follow up on this that Catherine mentioned when Adrian showed our best fitting model of GD1 and said it clearly sucks. It doesn't suck globally. It reproduces like a model of GD1 in a smooth halo reproduces this track. And if we put a progenitor over here at the present, it can reproduce one of the gaps that we see, but it doesn't reproduce many of these other density variations or the off-stream features. So that's like in the, I guess, second order sense, the model sucks. And what I wanted to then study is whether we can simply modify the model in order to get a better match to the data. And in particular, I was interested in seeing whether we can produce something like this spur in this encounter scenario. And so immediately after Adrian and I put out this data paper, I started working with David Hogg, and we set up the simplest example we could think of in order to test this idea. So we started with a line of stars. Here, like in the lightest blue, straight line, free space, so no gravity, and pass a point mass, so supermassive black hole at a distance of 100 parsec that goes vertically into the stream. And so you can see as time goes on, and like I'm showing this distribution then in darker colors, that the line gets extended and these kind of stars get a velocity kick and start moving to where the perturber passed. And when they reach the point where the perturber of the closest approach, they still keep moving on the other side and thus form the loop. So it is possible to get stars after an encounter to be displaced from the mainstream. And then our hope was that if we observe this loop feature at different orientations, it might look something like the spur. And so you can see right here, maybe this looks like a spur, like you can kind of convince now qualitatively that these features do look like something what we see in the data. But you also notice that we don't have a gap in this model. So it clearly we went like too far in our effort to simplify the problem. So then we thought, okay, what is the next simplest thing we could do? And we thought that this assumption of having a line of stars in the free space should be the next we address. And so then we set up this initialize a line of stars on a circular orbit in a logarithmic potential, which has a flat rotation curve and is a good first order approximation of the Milky Way. And so if we then do the same experiment, pass a supermassive black hole just beneath it, you can see that this loop still forms, but then one side of the loop is moving faster than the rest of the stream and the other slower. And so this way you can form both the loop, like the spur, and also the gap. And I'll just play this one more time. Because you'll notice that this loop is precessing around the stream. So at certain times, one side of the loop is right behind the stream. So it feels like in projection, we might actually see something like the spur only on offset on one side of the stream. And so just taking this conveniently pause snapshot, we get something like this and plotting it in angular coordinates. So you see that in projection, like most of the stream is like unaffected, but there's this loop that sticks out from the stream, goes through where the gap is, and then folds back in this side where it. And qualitatively, this looks like very similar to what we see in GD1. We see the spur, we see the gap, and this also looks like it's denser part of the stream than this part over here. And so it looked like this was then very exciting. It felt like we could actually do something something more quantitative and create an actual model of the GD1 stream. So then going back to our fiducial model, that is a mock stream created in a Milky Way-like potential and perturbing it with a massive object, we got, after some careful selection of impact parameters, we got a model that looks like this. And this model of GD1 encountered a massive object that's very dense, something like half a giga year ago, and it passed very close to the stream, moving at typical halo velocity. And so it was remarkable how qualitatively good this match was, because in this particular scenario, this loop of stars that is extended is kind of still contributing some stars in the gap, so it's not completely empty, exactly like what we see in the data. And then the loop seen in projection sticking out of the stream kind of matches both the extent and kind of the density of the loop, spur we see in GD1. And so we're very excited by this, because if you see that this is in this particular model, our perturber has a mass of 5 million solar masses, so it is in this interesting cosmological regime, whether we would like to really know if this really is a dark matter subhalo that passed by. But then the question is, of course, this is just one model, and we want to see how constraining the data is, or what is the uncertainty on these parameters, like what is the parameter space allowed over here. So to answer that, I'll just walk you through simplified models, so no longer like actual mock streams, where I vary each one of these parameters so that we see what sort of response they make, both on the appearance of the gap and of the spur. Okay, so starting with time, so the fiducial model will always be at the center, and then the parameter will increase towards the bottom. So all of the parameters here are fixed to the fiducial except for the time, which is increasing towards the bottom. And so we can see that initially this loop is small. It kind of grows with time, also rotates around, precesses around the stream, and then at a certain point it kind of gets aligned with the stream itself. And so I think this is empirically, it feels like the fact that we see loops, this loop sticking out of the stream, is telling us that the encounter had to have been fairly recent, because at later times it looks like it really, the loop mostly aligns itself with the stream. So we already are like gaining some intuition of what sort of what parts of the parameter space are allowed here. Then when we look at the mass, so fixing everything else and changing the mass, we see that both the size of the gap and the size of this loop are increasing with mass, which is, yeah, perhaps not so surprising. And this is almost exactly degenerate with the impact parameter. So the closer the perturber came to the stream, the larger the loop. However, the size of the gap looks fairly constant. So it looks like, from the fact that we have both we observe both the spur and the gap, we might be able to break at least some of these degeneracies. Then for the velocity, this turns out being almost exactly anti-correlated with the mass of the perturber. So if we go to higher velocities, we get a loop and a gap that are both smaller than what we have for more slowly moving perturbers. And then finally, the first models I showed were where the perturber was just a point mass. Then relaxed it to see to a Hernquist profile, and I'm showing here how the impact changes as a function of the scale parameter of that profile. And so 0 would be then a black hole, and 100 parsecs would be something like what is expected for a dark matter subhalo in this for this mass. And so you can see that the impact is on the stream is much higher when the perturber is dense. So yeah, it looks like it wouldn't be able actually to form the spur if it was like just a vanilla Lambda CDM subhalo that we know. And so that was exciting to see, kind of to get some intuition on what we can expect from observations of the gap and the spur. So these are very naive models, and we did a kind of cursory search of the parameter space by just comparing the width and the location of the gap and the size and location of the spur. But we didn't model any of the density contrast because we don't like this is just initialized as a line of SAR, so we would have to have a stream actual stream model, and that was like just left for future work. But even just with that, we can kind of put bounds on the parameter space. And so here is a corner plot where we think that that like good models live within these bounds. So you can see that as gained from our intuition, it looks like that the impact should have been fairly recent, within something like 1 giga year. It should have come fairly nearby, within 60 parsecs. We don't get much of a constraint on the velocity, but we do require this perturber to be fairly dense. And it's still in this interesting cosmologically regime for dark matter subhalos. And yeah, the initial like hand-picked fiducial model lives within all of these distributions, not surprisingly. So we have like some idea of what on the properties of the perturber, so we can then go see what could have been of the objects that we know in the Milky Way. And of course, there are all of the luminous clumps, the dwarf galaxies and the globular clusters. And thanks to the efforts of Josh and Amina and Eugene and everyone else who measured proper motions with Gaia, all of the satellites, means that we can integrate their orbits back and at every given time measure how far they were from this location where the GD1 gap currently is. And so showing here this relative distance is a function of look back time. We see that none of the, so there's like a lot of lines, but none come very close, none come even closer than 1 kiloparsec. And we require this impact parameter of something like 60 parsecs. So it looks like that modulo uncertainties in the gravitational potential, we can rule out any of the luminous objects as a perturber of GD1. However, you will notice that GD1 is crossing the disk. So then the next question is, could something in a disk have caused this? And Nicola Morisco has suggested that dense molecular clouds might do something like that. And so here I'm showing in the mass size plane our constraints on the GD1 perturber here in gray, positions of globular clusters as triangles, dwarf galaxies as squares, and then of molecular clouds in the outer disk as circles. So you can see that they look like they're just not dense enough to have produced what we require. Also, if we look at there, assuming they are orbiting within the disk, it looks like even the orbital configuration doesn't really work to create a spur. Of course, we can then overplot where the Lambda CDM subhalos should live in this plane, and they also seem to be more diffuse than what we infer for the GD1 perturber. So here is the band is showing the 1, 2, and 3 sigma scatter from, I think this is in Via Lactea measured, and so it would have been, yeah, there is some overlap over here, but it would have to been a very dense subhalo, like a 3 sigma deviation from what we expect. But when we remove all of these candidates based on their orbits, it looks like a fairly empty plot. So there is the question of really what caused it. Is it like a supermassive black hole that is just wandering in the halo? And the real reason, like why it's so exciting to do this study in the Milky Way, is that we have hope to of tracing these objects with more than just streams. So if we, for example, knew the present-day position of the of this object, we might go look for it in the gamma rays, like as a Fermi axis. Or if we know the past orbit, and if it crossed the disk, we might go look for the perturbances in the yay phase space file. Catherine is like so much happier now. And so yeah, we want to go search for disturbances in the disk. And there was also a suggestion last year by Ken Van Tilburg that subhalos, or like dense objects in the halo, might be also introducing different kinds of microlensing signatures in the halo as well. And so this is kind of our next step, where we want to go with this, not just say something about what could have happened, but like find where this perturber is at the present. And this is, with the current data, hard to do. And I'm here demonstrating why, because I'm showing here models from our study of that parameter space that all reproduce kind of this basic structure. They have a gap, they have a spur, and like this other side is kind of more or less aligned with a stream. And the problem is that they are all encountering the stream at different orbital angles. So meaning that at the present, we don't really have a good constraint where this thing should be. However, these models make very different predictions for the radial velocity difference between the spur and the mainstream. So in one case, it can be moving faster, slower, or there could even be, there are solutions where there's no velocity difference at all between these features. In proper motions, this looks, they have the same signature, and in a way, this is a nice way, even though in detail, the models are slightly different and will additionally constrain the impact parameters. They should always, since GD1 is moving like in a negative phi 1 direction, the spur should always have this higher proper motion than the stream at the same location, kind of along the stream. So this is a nice prediction that validates the model and definitely should be checked. The issue is that this is fairly small, and the uncertainties are large. So what we then did at the present is then try to narrow down our predictions of where the object, where the potential perturber could be at the present by measuring radial velocities. And so the landscape, when we submitted the first paper on the discovery of the spur, was that basically we had Sergei's radial velocity measurements. And here are their positions in blue along the stream, and here is the measurements below. Immediately, we applied for MMT Hector shell time, and after 6 months, we got some radial velocities in three fields, six fields, three on the stream and three along the spur. And yeah, just have to say, this has really been very well supported by everyone at the TDC, at the CFA, especially Nelson Caldwell and Phil Cargill. Yeah, they're the reason why we have these great velocities. So when we plot them, you can clearly see that the spur is associated with the stream, and this kind of nicely lies on track where Sergei measured those velocities with low-resolution spectroscopy. However, since this is a shell spectrograph, we can go we can really zoom in here, and so I calculated a polynomial that kind of goes through the stream radial velocities that we measured. So that's why some of the Sergei earlier measurements are offside of the stream. And yeah, there looks like there's some dispersion in the stream, very little in the spur, and basically no radial velocity offset between the stream and the spur. So it looks like this should be informing our model, our efforts at localizing the perturber at the present. And so what I then did is I added to our likelihood, in addition to requiring the gap of a certain width and the location of the spur, I required that also at these two locations, at like -33.5 and -29.5, there is no radial velocity difference between the spur and the stream. Okay, so yeah, people who who have been here since the beginning of the program can like track the, nicely the progress of this project. So this is kind of where I left off last week at the Gaia Sprint. I showed this. We can, after running this procedure, get some constraints on the parameters of the impact. And so here I am showing the two velocity components, or focusing on them and showing them as a function of mass. And you can see that we are sort of ruling out some parts of the parameter space, or like seeing some correlation. So it looks like that we are constraining this geometry of the impact. However, people like glancing in the upper part of this posterior corner diagram might be horrified by these very multimodal posteriors. So this is just to say that this is still a work in progress. So while I check that the models that are like within these islands look good, this is not a complete survey of the parameter space. So we can't really rule out many things, but we are gaining some information. So just for in the last few minutes, I wanted to show what happens when we sample this 2,000 of these models, find the orbit of the perturber, and then predict where they should be on the sky today. So that here, and so not quite like the LIGO search box, where it's more like a half of the sky, but you can kind of see that there are things to be learned here. So it looks like there's like this one big cloud that corresponds to high masses of the perturber, and it looks like there is something that looks kind of like a great circle, and they're different as a function of mass as well of the perturber, and I kind of wanted to stop here and say not subscribe to any of the predictions here, because I said we are still constraining this parameter space, but just say that like this model will make a prediction like that, and then when it's tested, it'll be either ruled out or correct. but then when I was talking to Adrian about it and showing him the orbits, he was like, "Oh, it looks like there's some end up close to Sagittarius." and I, of course, like we ruled out Sagittarius as a perturber because it never came close to the stream location that was perturbed. However, when you plot the Sagittarius stream, kind of looks fairly well aligned with like this other mode of other class of orbits that work as a perturber. And this becomes even more striking when you limit this sample to perturbers that are like slightly below 10 to the 7 solar masses. So it looks like really like tracing out this envelope of the Lohan-Majewski model of Sagittarius. And so of course, like this is very suspect, but I want to just do one more step. And so I'm showing here proper motion vectors for the perturber locations and this outer part of the Sagittarius stream. So you can see in this part where they're very close, they look like they're fairly well aligned. So I'm hoping you have a lot of questions and ideas on like what to do with this. I will end by saying that and this looks like an exciting model of GD1. We do make firm predictions that can be tested. And even if we learn that what caused the perturbation was a globular cluster associated with the Sagittarius. I think this really is showing the power of solar streams and demonstrating that we will be able to measure clumpiness in the dark matter using solar streams. And excitingly, there are already some deep data, like streams that have been observed more carefully than before, that already indicate some notion of density variations, indicating that, yeah, we'll just, we're just scratching the surface, and it will get really much more exciting in the years to come. So I'll stop here and take your questions.
Thank you, Anna.
I noticed in Adrian's talk that when the bar and disk were put in, that there were things that looked like these spurs that came off of his orbit. Mm-hmm. And also in your talk, you noticed that this thing comes close, it goes mm-hmm. to the disk. Have you looked at whether a disk could do that?
Yeah, so we have, like, in this model, we do have a disk. So the short answer is that GD1 crosses a disk fairly far away at 13 KPC. So there's just not much stuff over there. And we do require this dense nugget. So I tried placing globular clusters on circular orbits in the disk and trying to perturb it that way. And just never got, like, the spur was not oriented in the right way. It was kind of below the stream. So it looks like that wouldn't work.
So going with this idea of Sagittarius being perturbed, uh-huh. have you thought of what the initial mass of Sagittarius would need to be in order to host such a massive black hole, if that could have been a perturber?
Yeah, I feel like, well, I will hedge this a little bit. I started those runs close to 10^7, which is why we have the solutions close to 10^7. So I think it might be lower. Yeah, I think Sagittarius A star, this is kind of Milky Way. So yeah, it will this wouldn't really work, but we don't really have a good sense of how low mass of a black hole could have done in it.
Yeah, created by
Justin. What a fantastic talk. So I do think that the perturber you need is probably a bit dense to be comfortable with Lambda CDM subperiods, as you say. But that said, in the box where you had, potential perturbers, you did have a couple of dwarf galaxies sitting in there. And I just wonder what they are. What do you know what the names of the little...
Oh, no, I don't know that.
You're showing the half-light radius mm-hmm. of a dwarf galaxy. And if it's a perturber, it's dark matter halo that's perturbing. So I think you should not plot the squares like this, mm-hmm. because they don't actually mean what you want them to mean, right?
Yeah.
You want the scale radius of the halo, which hosts mm-hmm. these dwarfs, which will typically be at least 10 times.
Yeah.
Right? So they will be off to the right.
Yeah, that was kind of, we wanted to have something show where everything is, but it's not apples to apples because, right, those are not Hernquist profiles and all, but maybe we can discuss more. Yeah.
Well, I'm not sure I think what matters for you is density, right?
Yeah, so... because that's the intuition, we haven't really tested if that's what we are sensitive to.
Well, no, so I don't have an opinion. I mean, Vasily, if you tell me that there is no dwarf galaxy that's dense, then I think there's an issue with the
red. I think it says that, the size that I'm comparing to would be the, Hernquist profile, and, for dwarf galaxies, I'm plotting what is measured the half-light radius, when I guess the point is that this...
That's right, but if you know that that's the mass within the half-light radius, mm-hmm. and you know the half-light radius, then you know the density within the half-light radius, mm-hmm. right? Which is, I think, what matters for you.
Yeah, so, that's something, I haven't yet had time
to look into. We can talk about it more offline. I have many more questions as well, but I should let someone else.
I actually had a different question, which is about, one observation about your posterior that you showed us. They were all hitting the prior edge on the sides. So your models want to be even smaller size, it looks like.
Yeah,
If you let them go to one parsec, would they go to one parsec? I mean, is the second row from the bottom the size? It's the impact parameter, sorry.
No, this is size.
This is size. So I think they all want to be much smaller size than whatever. What was the
the prior here is just that it needs to be larger than zero.
They want to be zero.
Yeah. Okay. So I'm not.
So the second question was about how similar the velocities were, and.
You mean in the data that we observed?
In the radial velocities of the spur and the stream. Mm-hmm. And I think I mentioned this. Idea to you before that, you know, the streams are made of feathers, really, right? They're all aligned. Mm-hmm. And so if you do something to the cluster in the one last pericentric passage, mm-hmm. one of those feathers possibly can you misalign one of the
I think we looked feathers into that, and I guess Adrian
bring it out of
that,
the...
I think they're like aligned in the wrong way. They're like, mm-hmm. they wouldn't be coming from left to right. Like the feathers, they would be like from right to left.
But you're looking along the orbital. I mean, so you're saying there is a significant angle. You have a viewing angle onto the orbital plane. But still the feathers should be there, right?
They either went up that way or down that way.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so yeah. I guess
okay.
So right, the spur is coming out right this way, and I guess we found him like... in the other way.
But that's if your progenitor there. But if your progenitor is there, it will be going.
Vasily, we can continue to say.
So if you put the progenitor in a different location further down the stream.
But I think it wouldn't need to be like on this side, right?
Yeah, it doesn't change. The
orientation. Yeah.
Yeah. So just in favor of CDM, the little subhalos, of course, as they fall in, they get stripped and they become. They have to be denser than the local halo to survive. So they generally, the ones that live in the inner part of the galaxy are denser. And usually what's displayed is the whole catalog.
Yeah, so actually, this prediction or this band over here is actually taking whatever from this work. They provide the concentration mass relation as a function of distance from the host halo. So this is actually what you would expect. You know, it's like dark matter only, but in this at least radial range where GD1 is orbiting. So at least that part is. But I think I fully agree that we need like better. Predictions on the theory side for that, because I think a large part of this space is extrapolation. So I don't, think it would be interesting to simulate that. And I talked to some of the simulators at the CFA, and they say that they see the tails in the concentration mass relation as they go to the lower mass halo. So yeah.
So I guess I would imagine that. You know, the stream models would depend on the potential, right? And so you have a really nice fit to the that you showed, but on the other hand, you had the logarithmic potential, I guess, that you assumed. I mean, is it just an accident that this is?
This model like looks I tried it like in the log potential that we started from, and then I put it also in a model where we have the disk, the bulge, and the NFW halo. So like at least and those sort of scales, it still works. And for the reasons Adrian mentioned, we think that the bar shouldn't be affecting. But of course, like someone should do a proper survey, proper study.
Could you put back that plot you just had that showed the possible perturbers So I thought you were, the one where you said that they had the wrong orbits and things, because I thought you were saying at the end there is an association perhaps with the Sagittarius stream.
Yeah.
And so perhaps could it not be the globular clusters? And I think you actually said that. Globular.
Yeah.
So on that plot, which of those are the Sag globular clusters? And are they in that regime?
They are. like among the globular clusters.
Yes,
that we
yes.
Check.
Can you identify which right. are the SAG ones?
Yeah, I can put, place them on the plot, but they like none come very close though. That's yeah, even with the sampling, the uncertainties as well.
Okay.
I will have a look. So yeah. If any like where the Sagittarius dwarfs are over
yes,
here.
Yes, yeah, that's
yeah.
my question.
Yes.
And of course, there's more than one, so perhaps
yeah.
you would end up predicting, you know, more
yeah.
gaps. And it actually looked to me like there was a second mm-hmm. spur.
Yeah, it looks like there's
right?
a the,
yeah, there's
the block
a lower
feature
one.
That we
yeah,
yeah we only
yeah.
focus on this one.
Okay,
yeah, that's a great point. I will. I have to say that that Sagittarius plot is less than 24 hours old. So you're seeing this, yeah, as a developing story.
So if you just took a more general approach to a new population of objects mm-hmm. that doesn't overheat the disk.
Mm-hmm.
How unlikely is it that, or likely is it that one of these objects would come that close with that impact parameter? And even just a
yeah.
more general question, instead of seeing which of these objects would be the damage.
Yeah, yeah. So we kind of sweep this question under the rug, so we haven't actually done the proper calculation, motivated by Dennis Urkel's. He calculated the rates and said that GD1 should have encountered like one or two objects in throughout its history. So it felt like, okay, it's the, you know, order of magnitude. We'll like do the proper calculations later. But yeah, that's a great point because we do require it to pass like basically through the stream. So yeah, and that's why I'm actually excited. I was excited to hear about from Andrew and his students' work and would be interested to following up if this changes, if you have a stream like of stars that is kind of being crossed, maybe those rates would be enhanced, but yeah. But yeah, you're right. We should just say what the rates should be.
So Anna, if I assume it is a globular cluster that's associated with Sagittarius, but mm-hmm. one that we don't know about, do any of your plausible progenitors mm-hmm. end up hidden inside the disk?
Ah, I think so. Yeah, I guess other people will know where the disk. I think disk is like I guess Sagittarius is kind of hiding in the disk, right? So I think it's going something like this. So I think, yeah, it's definitely crossing that, I would say.
I think if it's a globular cluster mm-hmm. that is associated with Sagittarius and it happened long ago,
mm-hmm.
you don't really know what it
oh.
orbit is. So you can't really
mm-hmm.
rewind back easily
yeah.
to the time of the encounter, right? Because it's then
yeah,
three-body interactions.
So. Yeah, we need to revisit like how old the interaction is, right? In all of our models, it's fairly recent. Yeah.
So if the pattern was is in the disk, you have a better idea where it is located now because you know the orbit of the GD1.
Mm-hmm.
So you know when it hit the disk plane. So yeah. So maybe you know if you assume that the pattern is in the halo, then you have to explore a lot. But if it is located in a two-dimensional plane, then it might be much easier. So
yeah, that's fair. That's a good point. Unless I don't know, like if it's outside of our like viewing zone of the disk, like you know, but, yeah.
So just on this mm-hmm. impact rate issue.
Mm-hmm.
So globs are, you know, there's only
yeah.
150 or whatever.
Yeah.
And so, there's just not enough of them.
And the most are in the bulge. Yeah.
Yeah. And then it's actually a good thing. I think that the number of subhalos is depleted because at 20 kiloparsecs or so,
mm-hmm.
there shouldn't be any streams at all because they'd be so terribly battered around by all the subhalos. So it's important that the numbers got turned down a little bit. It's actually, I sort of wonder, it's almost a fluke that there's the right number to make
an impact,
to
but yeah.
streams, but not destroy them.
Yeah, that's, I don't know, I feel like it's really, yeah, exciting to see that feature, that it is very, very kind of specific. It doesn't look like very perturbed, like the spur is also very thin. It looks like that it's dynamic, like kinematically cold as well, so it doesn't look like it's something like that's been messed up a lot.
We have time for a couple questions. If not, let's thank Anna again.
Thank you.